When I joined the Army, even before the turn of the century, it was the fulfillment of all my boyish hopes and dreams. The world has turned over many times since I took the oath on the plane at West Point, and the hopes and dreams have long since vanished.
There are few men in American history who can look back, as the shadows of life lengthen, on a military career as distinguished as that of Douglas MacArthur. There are fewer still who have earned the words of high tribute that are spoken now.
General MacArthur may say old soldiers never die. They just fade away. Physically they will, but the great deeds of men live forever after them.
To speak of General Douglas MacArthur, my longtime friend and for years my direct superior, is to invite the use of superlatives. I have not known a more forceful and competent leader, nor have I encountered a finer intellect in or out of public life. Our nation has been indeed fortunate that such a gifted leader should have dedicated so many years of his life to the service of the American public and to the cause of freedom everywhere. With respect and affection, shared I know throughout the nation, I salute this distinguished general and outstanding American.
I'm proud to join in this much-deserved tribute to General Douglas MacArthur. I had the honor of serving under General MacArthur in the Solomon Islands in World War II. And I do not think that there is any doubt that history will record that the strategy which he followed in the Pacific in bringing about the defeat of Japan under conditions which were adverse and which were fraught with danger will be considered as one of the great military feats of arms in the history of our country. His record in the First War and in the Second War, his contribution in moving Japan into a strong democratic position in the days following its collapse, are almost unprecedented. General MacArthur looks back on a long record which dated to strengthening the United States and increasing its influence around the world. We are in his debt, and I think it most appropriate as he approaches the afternoon of this long life that we all pay him justified tribute.
June 3rd, 1899 is the day, and MacArthur is the name. Cadet Douglas MacArthur, who comes to the United States Military Academy at West Point to take his place in the long gray line. The America of Cadet MacArthur's time is the America of President William McKinley, a nation seeking its destiny in the newborn. The America of Lillian Russell, toast of two continents. Of Buffalo Bill Cody, last of the great frontier scouts. Of Teddy Roosevelt and his Rough Riders. The life of a cadet at West Point at the turn of a century is as regimented and severe as at any time in its history. And yet, in every subject, Douglas MacArthur excels. He compiles a four-year record of 98.14, the highest average attained by any cadet in the first 100 years of the Academy's history. MacArthur shows, too, an interest in athletics that will continue throughout his life. He is manager of the cadet football team in his senior year and wins his letter as an outfielder in the first Army-Navy baseball game. On his graduation in 1903, it is said, there has never been a cadet quite like him. In the same year at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, shy, obscure Orville Wright and his brother Wilbur send man's first powered airplane into flight. And Henry Ford sets out to produce the horseless carriage that is to put America on wheels. In 1904, Teddy Roosevelt is selected president for a second term, and he sends General Arthur MacArthur, remarkable in his resemblance to Teddy, to Manchuria to observe the Russo-Japanese War. Young Douglas accompanies his father. In 1908, William Jennings Bryan is defeated for the presidency. 4 years later, Thomas Woodrow Wilson succeeds where Bryan has three times failed. And across the Atlantic, Kaiser Wilhelm of Germany and Archduke Francis Ferdinand of Austria hunt together. The assassination of one, Ferdinand, in 1914, and the fateful decision of the second, the Kaiser, plunges mankind into its first world war, a war that will last for 4 years and will bury 8 million men. On April 6, 1917, President Wilson signs the declaration of war against Germany. As America mobilizes, Major Douglas MacArthur urges the organization of a division of National Guard units from as many states as possible, a division that will spread across the country like a rainbow. Thus it is that the famed Rainbow Division is born and that Douglas MacArthur, promoted to colonel, is made its chief of staff. Soon, convoys of U.S. ships are Europe-bound. American boys are off to win the war that will end all wars, not knowing nor dreaming that a quarter of a century later, their own sons will make this same long journey. On the battlefields of France, Douglas MacArthur is to write a record of heroism that is to make of him, at 38, the youngest American general in the war. Secretary of War Newton Baker calls MacArthur the bravest frontline general in France. He is twice wounded, twice gassed, decorated 13 times, and cited 7 times more for extreme bravery under fire. In a battlefield ceremony, General Pershing presents MacArthur with a Distinguished Service Cross. And after the armistice, the general comes home to take up a new and entirely different challenge, remembered now by Army's former football coach, Earl Red Blake.
Back in 1919, when I was a cadet, first classman, at that time there was considerable agitation in Congress to do away with West Point. The war was over, the morale of the place was very low, and about that time a young 38-year-old general came to West Point. It was General MacArthur, and it was he who saved the military academy because he brought not only morale back to the Corps of Cadets, but he also established a rapport with the Congress, with the rest of the Army, that was exceedingly important in those days. General MacArthur had a great interest in athletics. There was nothing synthetic about General MacArthur's interest in sports, because actually he was a baseball player as a cadet. He also managed the football team. I remember so well when I was a cadet playing baseball. I think he was greatly disturbed about the fact that I was not hitting too well. Now, as superintendent, it was rather unusual for the superintendent to come out and coach a baseball player. But I would say this, that one afternoon, he was so disturbed at my hitting, he came out, unloosened his Sam Brown belt, his blouse, and proceeded to give me some instruction in hitting. Actually, after he got through, I think I was less of a hitter than I was before. It is probably the only thing in his life in which he was a failure.
Failures are few as MacArthur in 1930 reaches the pinnacle of military heights. At 50, he is sworn in as Army Chief of Staff and pledges to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. On July 28, 1932, Army tanks and cavalry troops sweep through the streets of Washington with orders to disperse the Bonus Army and to carry out what MacArthur later says is the most distasteful duty of my career. The government's action is denounced in many circles as brutal, unnecessary, and unconstitutional, and Douglas MacArthur becomes, overnight, one of the most disliked men in America. The incident does not deter incoming President Roosevelt from continuing the general as chief of staff. Together, they review the inaugural parade. They have their differences, but FDR will say, "Douglas, you are my American conscience." In the early 30s, the American Army's strength tumbles to a pitiful 60,000 enlisted men, and there is talk of abolishing the Army altogether. At West Point on graduation day, June 1933, the general makes an impassioned and prophetic plea for preparedness. "History has proved," he says, "that nations once great that neglected their national defense are dust and ashes. Let us be prepared lest we too perish." Then the mood changes, the voice softens, and the old soldier pronounces his benediction on the graduates.
"Young comrades in arms, happy landings, and God be with you."
2 years later, Secretary of War Dern adds an oak leaf cluster to Douglas MacArthur's Distinguished Service Medal, and the general at the age of 55 retires as Chief of Staff. He has earned virtually every high honor the Army can bestow.
"I shall wear it upon my uniform, where, for all eyes, it will stand as an outward symbol of the devotion, the efficiency, and the accomplishments of the officers and the soldiers whom it has been my high honor to command. For them and for myself, I thank you."
The call of duty next takes Douglas MacArthur to the Philippines. Manuel Quezon, president of the Philippine Commonwealth and the general's longtime friend, asks MacArthur if he will direct the defense buildup of the islands. The task begins in 1936 with Major Dwight D. Eisenhower joining MacArthur as his senior aide. Despite American apathy and a limited Philippine defense budget, MacArthur builds a compact, disciplined military force. Retiring from the American Army after 38 years, he remains in the islands as war clouds gather over the Orient. Shanghai, August 1937. Japan, the rising sun, casts its shadow across the Far East. The bells are tolling. But Americans do not hear them. They have Joe DiMaggio and a host of baseball heroes. Many are the boys who dream of being a Joe DiMaggio or some other sports idol in this wonderful summer of 1937. And there are others who send model airplanes into flight in the skies over America. While Japanese aircraft deliver their bombs on the gunboat Panay, and American blood is shed.
Thank you.
young America hears music of a different kind. For swing is the thing, and Goodman is the king. Now the Philippines and its people are of growing strategic importance in the Pacific. And in July 1941, Douglas MacArthur is recalled to duty as commander of U.S. Army forces in the Far East. At home, others are summoned, too.
Rise and shout, boys. Up!
The first peacetime draft in U.S. history is law, and though the gripes are many, Army life is still something to joke about.
Attention, each tent. This camp is now run under new management. Relaxation. More money. These are my aims, the new GI issue. Each guy gets two things.
Hooray for Snafu, gives us all limousines. No more drill, no salutes.
No more cleaning latrines.
The big parade grows longer. G.I. Joe's serving their country for $21 a day, once a month. On the production line, the gals step in when the guys step out. The depression of the 30s is making way for the boom of the 40s. Happy days are here again. And so the days dwindle down to a golden few. September, November, and on an autumn afternoon, Navy meets Army in football, while America, unknowing, marches towards its December date with destiny. This is a Navy year in football. How great each midshipman's joy. How deep each cadet's despair. How ironic the words of Japanese Ambassador Nomura.
Very happy to arrive at San Francisco. My purpose of coming to United States to improve our relation between two countries.
Interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin.
The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air, President Roosevelt has just announced.
No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory.
From these dark and bitter days in the Philippines emerged two symbols of America's heroic resistance. One is Douglas MacArthur. The other is Corregidor, the rock, the altar of freedom upon which thousands of American fighting men will offer the last full measure of their devotion. The hammering from the heavens is relentless, contorting and convulsing pockmarked Corregidor. In underground tunnels, men live like animals. Rations cut in half and halved again, 14 ounces a day to live and to fight on. And yet the hopelessly outnumbered troops hold out. December, January, February, and into March 1942, when the men bid their commander goodbye and Godspeed. The general has been ordered to Australia by President Roosevelt to take command of Allied forces in the Southwest Pacific. His arrival in Melbourne thrills the free world, and his first words become his battle cry. I have come through, and I shall return. To the north, Corregidor is in its death agony. May 6th, 1942, the hopeless carnage ends. No army, says MacArthur, has ever done so much with so little. America, in all her history, has known no darker hour. Until we claim the ghastly remnants of Corregidor, MacArthur says, we stand unredeemed before mankind. There lies our holy grail.